I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Down in the dumps, still doping out the contradictions of billionaire populism in a country feeling out of sorts, maybe out of itself. Who's to explain? We're remembering many great splainers of America who, if they had a field of expertise, talked and wrote outside of it. Norman Mailer and Mary McCarthy were novelists. Mae West and Chris Rock, comedians. Yogi Berra, the Yankees catcher. Noam Chomsky is a scientist of human language. So we're beginning what feels like a series of radio hours on America in 2017 with talkers across boundaries. Roberto Unger is a Brazilian philosopher and lawyer. Cornel West is a lay preacher in the African-American tradition. Every 20 years or so, Professors Unger and West teach a course together at Harvard. This spring it's called American Democracy. They bring a reading list but no notes to the stage, and they are not teaching political science. They're teaching a compound of American wisdom literature, theology, history, and their own lifetimes of experience. They're giving us a taste of it in conversation this week at the Harvard Divinity School. Cornel West got us started.
We read de Tocqueville, we read a number of texts having to do with not just American democracy, but the American empire, and whether, in fact, we're wrestling with a cultural decay and a political lethargy and a escalating wealth inequality that's sucking much of the democratic energies out of the empire. And how do we revitalize the democratic possibilities within the empire? And that's very much what the course is about. But I want to defer to my dear brother Roberto Unger.
My view throughout has been that the most important attribute of the United States is its extraordinary vitality. It seethes with human energy and hope. And its historical tragedy has been the historical tragedy of all the other great democracies of the world, has been to deny equipment and opportunities to the majority of ordinary men and women. Hmm. The instruments that they need to transform this human energy into constructive action. The understanding of that problem and the exploration of a solution to it is the main theme of our course.
Hmm. What's the intersection of your thinking, of your histories, of your fields?
Well, I'm not sure that Cornell and I have fields.
That's the best kind.
Cows have fields. We have ideas.
All serious thought requires divorce. That is, the separation of this false marriage of method and subject matter. So the division of culture into these reified disciplines and methods is the enemy of thought.
Cornell?
That's what the universities are. They're professional managerial sites for the formation of an educated class for, at Harvard, of course, a ruling class. And our aim is to try to shatter the assumptions and presuppositions upon which so many of those disciplines rest. And so to be prophetic is to try to unleash Socratic energy and try to unleash utopian possibilities to engage in the world as it is in light of a vision of the not yet. And so Roberto Unger is an exemplary prophetic, not just thinker, but figure. Now, he's from Brazil, of course. That's still America, but that's down south. And so he looks at the American empire from a particular vantage point. Brazil has its own very rich history as well as its own deep sufferings and inequalities. We have a rich history in the United States as well as deep sufferings and inequality. I mean, Roberto and I love to go at it because there's a sense in which he's much more tied to Emerson and Whitman, and I'm tied to Melville and the blues. Melville's much darker, he's much bleaker. Moby Dick is the exemplary American novel. Confidence Man, Pierre, we can go on and on. Benito Cereno is probably the finest piece of literary depiction of the complex dynamics of a structural domination right there on the boat.
On the slave ship.
Right on the slave ship with Babo. And I say that because we do have magnificent overlap as thinkers who are trying to unleash utopian possibilities and Socratic energies, to stay in contact with the vitality and the culture, but also to be very, very attuned to the greed and the resentment and the envy and the revenge.
How do you wrap yourself, Roberto, in Emerson and Whitman? Is that fair?
Well, the American prophets, and they are among the American prophets, had as their central message the idea of the greatness of the ordinary man and woman. The central faith of democracy.
The infinitude of the private man, as Emerson said.
That there are unlimited depths within the ordinary, and that we can ascend to a higher life. It's the idea of a shared bigness.
Shared bigness is a key note in Roberto Unger's mind. Sounds like his very own version of Make America Great Again.
That's the central idea. And our shared interest is to ask under what conditions this idea can be made real. And that requires the transformation of consciousness.
Can I ask, did the American giants think we could reach that greatness together? I'm not sure Emerson did. And certainly the moral of Moby Dick is, and Herman Melville is, no. The Pequod went down, and it was the model of America.
The tendency of the Americans has been to understate the mutability of society, but to overstate the extent to which the individual can rescue himself, as a little Napoleon placing the crown upon his own head. It is one of the aims of our course to evaluate this message and to change it.
For listeners who just landed, each of you, two, three, four, not more than five earmarks and leading indicators of American democracy today. What is it? 2017.
I think American democracy resides in the best of the hearts and souls of citizens, but we have an oligarchic economy. We have plutocrats reigning. We have a citizenry that's being amused to death and therefore implicitly consenting to its own subordination, feeling helpless, feeling hopeless, feeling impotent. And we have a ruler who is not just narcissistic, but is tied to those plutocratic and oligarchic elites because he has no ideas of his own for the most part. As you write in your powerful formulations, though, Brother Chris, he's all theater, he's all spectacle, he's all image.
Reality
TV.
He is
a product. He's a product of a market-driven American culture. He's a product of the worst of the American empire when it comes to white supremacy, male supremacy. I've said quite explicitly that Brother Donald Trump is a gangster in character. He's grabbing women's parts. That's gangster. Taking the oil from Iraq. That's gangster. We've seen the gangsterization of the culture at work for a while. Now it's spilled over into the political sphere where you actually have the head of the empire, an explicit gangster, and not that many people wanting to call it for what it is. So there's not a whole lot of democracy left. It's just somehow we've got to revitalize it.
Well, the limit of the ambitions of the progressives has been to humanize the project of their conservative adversaries. So one concern is the insularity of the advanced practice of production in the United States. There is a new style of production that is emerging in the world. It is nowhere more developed than in the United States. It is a knowledge-intensive, radically experimental, and innovative economy. But it is confined. It is confined to insular vanguards. It exists in services as well as manufacturing. It exists in agriculture, precision and scientific agriculture. But the vast majority of the labor force is excluded from it. What we should want is an inclusive vanguardism.
MIT can find talent anywhere in the world and help bring it to fruition. How far short of inclusive vanguardism is MIT, that model?
What we want is for this form of experimental, flexible, innovative production to be widely disseminated in the economy, so that increasing parts of the labor force have access to it.
What Roberto Unger means is not good jobs at good wages. He's talking advanced work for most of the workforce.
One test is that more people in more parts of American life, in more classes, have more access to the devices of what is most advanced, to create, to construct, to invent, to innovate, to treat the American people not just as a bunch of beneficiaries of entitlements, but as agents. What we now have in the United States and in many contemporary societies is that the right has come to embody the cause of energy, of dynamism, of creation, and the left of the sugarcoating of the savage form of energy that the right proposes. That's a formula for defeat in politics.
Spell it out. Yeah.
We want the left to represent the cause of energy. And that's what this inclusive vanguardism and this educational change are about.
But spell out the sugarcoating of what?
The sugarcoating of the present form of economic organization. So if you ask, what's the project of the progressives today? The simple answer is, it's the project of their conservative adversaries with a humanizing discount. They're the people who bring the sugar. For example, at election time, instead of proposing a structural alternative, they genuflect to progressive taxation, just to show whose side they're on, even though they know that progressive taxation has only a marginal effect on the distribution of economic opportunity and advantage. So one thing we want in a progressive political economy is that no worker should have to work as if he were a machine. In Henry Ford's assembly line or Adam Smith's pen factory, the worker acts as if he were a machine. But the purpose of the machine is to do for us what we have learned to repeat so that we can reserve our time for the not yet repeatable. What we want is that economically dependent wage labor over time give way to the higher forms of free labor, which are self-employment and cooperation. We have to reimagine the form of economic life. To do that, we need to change education, and we need to create a high-energy democracy that does not need crisis to make change possible.
Both these men are talking about lost energy at work, and especially in progressive politics. The heirs of the New Deal have no project as big as the problems right in front of them. The wealth and income gap, say, or the climate breakdown. Coming up, their genealogies of our condition, turning points in the history that got us here. Professors Unger and West draw their own maps differently. This is Open Source. Cornel West and Roberto Unger are on a trail blazed in the 1830s by the young French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville, taking notes for his classic Democracy in America. Not the least of what's missing in 2017 is an almost fierce devotion to human equality that de Tocqueville felt in young America, equality of condition, as he put it, in a common enterprise. I asked our guests, don't we all feel ourselves careening today toward a two-tier society embedded generation to generation?
Yeah, I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville is still one of the most acute observers and analysts of the American Empire, but he writes in the 1830s, and he's primarily writing about European immigrants making their way here. He talks about indigenous peoples and their land itself being taken. This is right at the time of Andrew Jackson, who is the hero, of course, of Donald Trump and the Trial of Tears of Cherokee indigenous peoples, and of course, Andrew Jackson himself being a very wealthy slave holder. Tocqueville goes on to talk about the African slaves. So he's already talking about America as an empire within the continent. We're on the way to the Mexican War, which was nothing but gentrification writ large. It was a land grab. It was a power grab against Mexicans taking their land at the point of a gun. So de Tocqueville has a sense of an incipient empire. We are now, in the 21st century, seeing the decay and decline of that empire that has 4,800 military facilities, almost 1,000 outside of the country. And it reminds one very much, we talk about this in our class, of what Gibbon had to say about Rome, right? Imperial overreach, the corruption of the elites, and the cultural decay of the citizens. Mm. And it led toward an internal collapse with the external foreigners, those outside moving in. How did Brother Bernie Sanders put it the other day? He said the Democratic Party, the elites want first-class seats on a Titanic. That's where it's headed. When you begin to adjust yourself and normalize a neo-fascist in the making like Donald Trump and vote for a number of his appointees and so forth, it's already clear that you've lost your fight. and what Brother Roberto says, the energy and dynamism and vitalism associated with the right rather than the left is a sign. The left is barren, empty, vacuous, imitative, derivative. Mm. And if there's no creative breakthrough on the left, then the left is over. It's already weak and feeble. And it's just a matter of isolated voices that goes down swinging as the Titanic hits the iceberg. And we don't know what form, you know, nuclear catastrophe, ecological catastrophe.
The historical objective of the progressives, of the leftists, of the socialists, of the liberals, is not equality of outcome. The historical objective is bigness, what I call a shared bigness. It's our ascent. It's the bringing up of human life, of the life of the ordinary man and woman, to a higher plane of intensity, scope, and capability. And the method is change in the structure of society, in its institutions, and in particular in the institutions of the market economy and of democratic politics. Hmm. The central ideal of the progressives must be an ideal of the enhancement of agency, of the ability to act in the world. Hmm. And to set one's mark on the world and to turn the tables against one's circumstance. That's what we want. And all of the ideas about institutions and consciousness are subservient to that goal.
Roberto, on a Tocquevillian scale of extreme peril, give us a number, 1 to 10. Where are we on the chart?
Danger is disorientation. Danger arises from being lost. So that's not just the situation in the United States. Let's begin one step back. That's the situation in the world. Humanity has been living through a long revolutionary period, at least since the early 19th century. It has had a political wing represented by the projects of liberalism, socialism, and democracy. And it has had a personal wing represented by Romanticism and the worldwide popular Romantic culture. This revolutionary project, the project of raising the ordinary up, is paradoxically strong and weak. It is strong because throughout the world, it continues to command the agenda. All the other projects in the world respond to it. But it is weak because its adepts, its champions, its supporters, no longer know what its next step should be. Mm. And there's no better place to see that situation played out than the United States today. That's why it's dangerous. It's dangerous because it's disoriented. And because it's disoriented, it could do anything.
Mm. On a simple scale, as simple as you can make it, Cornell, the American peril today, how grave?
Out of 10?
Yeah.
I would say we're at about 8.5 in terms of danger and peril measure, about 8.5.
That gives room. That leaves room for work.
There's always room for bearing witness and having some fortitude, which is a fusion of moral courage and magnanimity, greatness of character. The problem is that we don't have institutional capacity to translate it into the kind of alternative programmatic things that Roberto talks about. Hmm. There's always possibility for the artists or for the journalists or for the writer or for one in one family. You can do that in the fascist context, you know.
Danger is the reverse side of possibility. Remember Whitehead's remark, the philosopher Whitehead, the business of the future is to be dangerous. Danger comes from openness.
One of the subtitles of their semester course for all comers in a Harvard lecture hall is the genealogy, the ancestry of the mess we're in. How far back does it go?
Roberto has a wonderful story about the progressive movement, the populist movement, and the New Deal liberalism. I tend to zero in on 1973. That was the relative death of the social movements. You had the unbelievable overflow of democratic energy from below, of working people, black people, anti-war movements, feminist movements, anti-homophobic movements. 73, you get structural crisis in the global economy, the competition from Japan at that time, West Germany at that time, Arabs move toward monopoly of oil production, contesting Texas and others, and the response is this neoliberal response, which is a major transfer of wealth from poor and working people to the top 1%. You privatize, you financialize, and you militarize. Mm. So you end up with military Keynesianism under Reagan, where he expanded the state in the name of a limited state, but it was for military. It was cutbacks. Mm. It was speed-ups at the workplace. It was major, major undermining of social programs for the weak and vulnerable. But the military-industrial complex expanded in a major way in the context of that Cold War. And Reaganism has set the tone for the 40 years. And Bill Clinton comes in, and what does he do? He has to steal the thunder from the right. He's tough on crime, mass incarceration regime. Massive transfer of wealth still taking place to the well-to-do because he is tied to Wall Street. He's tied to corporate sponsors and donors and so forth. But he's very charismatic and he's very charming and he presents himself somehow as tied to New Deal liberalism, but no, not at all. He's a different kind of character.
Before you use the word again, Cornell, we collect definitions of neoliberalism. What does it mean to you?
Privatize. Financialize, militarize. You see it in prisons, you see it in schools. It's the criminalizing of poor people, especially people of color, in which bad behavior more and more means you're on the way to the mass incarceration regime. That's part of the militarizing of street, of school, of everyday life of poor and working people to contain them, as in fact we shift from an industrial-centered capitalism where we had American Motors producing products to now Wall Street. Hedge fund, private equity entities that would produce deals, not products. So they do very well, but it doesn't translate at all. And you end up with this hemorrhaging of billions and billions and billions of dollars in private pockets. The level of obscenity and spiritual profanity of wealth and greed in the last 40 years is waiting for a Theodore Dreiser or a Thomas Pynchon or Virginia Woolf to tell the full story of. It's a crime against humanity, given the fact that one out of two children of color under six in America live in poverty. I mean, that's the level of social pathology that we're talking about, and it reminds one of the rule of kings and queens in the early modern period.
Roberto, what's your genealogy of this condition?
So let's take three moments in American history that show us how the country got to where it is now.
Please.
So first, what built the country in the first half of the 19th century? It was the combination of two sets of initiatives. On top, there was a Hamiltonian project of mobilizing the resources of the country, financial, physical, and human, to build the country. And that's what really built the United States. It was this combination of massive mobilization by the government from on top with democratization of particular sectors below. Then comes a second moment, the two major traditions of progressive reform in the United States. There's the tradition of defending the small guy against the big guy, small business against big business, from Jefferson to Brandeis. Then we come to a third moment, the New Deal, the last great period of institutional renovation in American life. There was an early period of institutional experimentalism, mainly focused on the orchestration of competition, on concerted action between government and big private business, not the radicalization of competition. Then there was a second period of the development of antidotes to economic insecurity, like Social Security.
Yep.
And then finally, it ended in a narrow focus on the popularization of consumption, a market in mass consumption goods. Now, the Democratic Party and the other supposedly progressive entities in the United States have failed to come up with a sequel to Roosevelt's New Deal. That's what made possible this vacuum into which right-wing populism came. Now we need something completely different. Now look at the situation. The progressives had limited themselves to sugarcoating, to genuflecting to progressive pieties rather than causing transformative effects. And then into this empty space comes the adventurer. But right-wing populism has no project. It has no institutional agenda. And because it has no institutional agenda, it is fragile. If the progressives had a project, this situation would provide them with an immense opportunity. But until now, they have had no project.
Imagine they had one. Other approaches to this crisis slash opportunity. What would this project look like?
A movement that has to be established in politics, including inside the Democratic Party, but outside it as well, looking for power, not just national power, but power in the states, but at the same time, making proposals for the reorganization of every aspect of American life. In other words, it can't just be a project about the change of institutions. It has to be a project also about the change of consciousness. The first question on each of our lips has to be, where are the others? Mm. We cannot, in the attempt to devise answers to this question, allow ourselves to surrender to an idolatry of the established institutions, as the Americans often have. We should want first to raise the temperature of politics. That means to organize the conditions for greater popular engagement in political life through public financing of electoral activity and through free access to the means of mass communication in favor of organized social movements as well as political parties. Second, we need to hasten the pace of politics. To create constitutional mechanisms for the rapid resolution of impasse. There are two distinct principles in the American constitutional design. There's a liberal principle of fragmentation of power, and there's a conservative principle of the slowing down of politics. Make it hard to change things through politics. We should want to reaffirm the liberal principle, but to repudiate the conservative one. Now, there's a third domain for institutional change in democratic politics, and that is the reinvention of federalism. The federal system is supposedly a device for experimentation. The states are described as laboratories of experimentation,
right. Even anvils in the Federalist
Papers. If you ask me where to begin, I would say in the United States, the most plausible place to begin is the reinvention of federalism, to create a vast storehouse of experiments, of counter models of the national future, because that would be acceptable to the right as well as to the left.
Roberto Unger's purposes sound grand scale, maybe utopian, moving decisively past the age of oil and coal, let's say, or maybe redesigning healthcare from the bottom up, as Obamacare did not.
Cornell, can I ask, do you hear, as I keep hearing, little hints of Trumpism in what Roberto is saying? You know, heat it up, speed it up, open up communications, Twitterize it, make it a show, talk about greatness. Of course, we ended up with a reality TV star as president, and we can't quite believe it.
When Trump talks about heated up, he's talking about manipulating corporate media. He played CNN, MSNBC, the way Paganini played a violin. 2 billion free hours of media. That's not heating anything up. All that is a whole lot of activity of manipulation that allows him to be visible.
But there's a legitimate element in Chris's remark, which is this. Mm-hmm. Populism, whether it's right-wing populism or left-wing populism, is in politics a kind of liquefaction. It melts down the structures. It's the fluid moment. And its future is then determined by whether it has or not an institutional legacy. Because the waves of enthusiasm, of liquid action, come and go. And they only persist if they leave an institutional legacy. Now I am saying that this right-wing populism in the United States has no institutional program. And because of this, it is fragile. And because it is fragile, it offers the progressives an immense opportunity.
That's what I keep hearing in you, that there's some example here to be seized and repurposed.
Exactly. But for that, we need ideas and we need movement.
But the appearance in a culture of superficial spectacle is not populism at all. You see, populism, going back to the 19th century, was actually people engaged in self-organization against elites, farmers coming together. The early Thomas Watson, now we know he ended up Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, but the early Tom Watson was against elites for the empowerment of the very principle that Roberto's talking about, which is to find the miraculous in the everyday and to find the extraordinary in the ordinary. That is the democratic sensibility.
But I understand part of the context of Chris's question to be this. The conventional conservative view of politics is that there are basically two kinds of politics. There's a cold institutional politics, politics within the ground rules, within the institutions.
Which both parties love.
That's the dominion of the technocratic centrism.
Right.
And then there's a hot extra-institutional or anti-institutional politics. That's Caesarism. That's the personalist leader who liquefies things against the institutions. Now, what we desire is a politics that is both hot and institutional. That's the miraculous alchemy that we have to perform in the transformation of democratic politics. And that is the partial affinity between a progressive view in politics and this populism. Mm.
Coming up, thinking big and making new rules. Roberto Unger's model of what's needed is FDR's industrial scramble to make those tanks and planes that won World War II. This is Open Source. For America in the doldrums, it's the progressives who need a great project, our crosstalking guests keep saying. Cornel West, lay preacher, returning to the Harvard Divinity School this spring, and Roberto Unger, still a political player back home in Brazil, a voluminous essayist who got tenure at the Harvard Law School 50 years ago. I hear them saying in different ways that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s was the best idea of the last century, that it needs not just a sequel, but also repairs at the old foundations.
White supremacist slavery was the foundation of the American economy. That the value of slaves in 1862 was higher than all of the manufacturing units, factories, and railroads. So that it's not just a matter of race as a factor. We talk about this in our class. And de Tocqueville understood this. He says these are the non-democratic, anti-democratic, illiberal preconditions of American liberalism. And it's barbarism. These are crimes against humanity that we're talking about. Now, jump forward. Okay, the New Deal. Why did the New Deal exclude agricultural laborers and domestic maids? Well, 65% of black women were domestic maids, and the vast number of black workers were agricultural laborers, and the Southern elites who were part of the New Deal wanted to make sure that this building of a new middle class was still deeply racist and white supremacist. So again, even when we're talking about progressive movements, we have to talk about the crucial ways in which male supremacy, white supremacy, and other forms of discrimination were operating as mechanisms not just of exclusion, but of domination. You see, Jim Crow wasn't just excluding black people from the mainstream. It was terrorizing black people. It was lynching black people. It was psychic terror, teaching children that you're not worth a dime, and so forth and so on, you see. And part of the challenge, and we've talked about this with Brother Bernie Sanders, again, I keep coming back to him, because there's a sense in which all of the things that Brother Roberto's talking about has to be translated in terms of institutional capacity. And at present, if we can't have a radical, democratic, multiracial coming together against Wall Street, against empire, against vicious patriarchal domination, and the treatment of gay, lesbians, and bisexuals, and trans folk. Homophobia is not just a PC category, right? It's a way of demonizing and demeaning human beings. And as a Christian, I'd say human beings made in the image and likeness of God. So in that sense, the one addition I would make, which is fundamental to Brother Roberto's story, is the ways in which this slavery and then Jim Crow, which was slavery by another name, and now Jim Crow Jr., the new Jim Crow, which is another form of vicious domination in regard to the hyper-incarceration regime that's been at work. What is it, 300,000 in the 1970s, up to 2.5 million today. Mm. How does that become part and parcel, integral, constitutive of the new kind of radical democratic politics we must have?
By solving a series of practical problems. So we have to trust the practical ingenuity of the American people. Let's take an example. I was speaking before about education. It's one of the bridges between the transformation of the economy and the transformation of democratic politics. The principle must be, and it is, I assume, universally accepted in the United States, that the quality of the education that a child receives should not depend on the happenstance of where it is born. In a country that is very large, very unequal, and federal in structure, like the United States, that means reconciling the local management of the schools with national standards of investment and quality. And to do that, three instruments are required. First, a national system of assessment, of performance of each school, so we know what works. Second, a mechanism to redistribute resources and, if necessary, staff from richer places to poorer places, thus the reinvention of federalism. And third, a procedure for corrective intervention when a local school system repeatedly fails despite all support. Take it over through cooperative action within the federation, fix it and return it fixed. That's an example of an arrangement that should appeal to a very broad part of the American population. But it comes to life only in the context of a more inclusive, progressive project for the transformation of both the economy and politics.
I think what the challenge there is that usually the history of federalism reinforces white supremacists, and I would add the male supremacist practices. That's precisely why states' rights, that's why Ronald Reagan went to Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1980 and called for states' rights and was endorsed by the Klan that same night. States' rights historically has been domination of black folk, keeping control of black folk. So when it comes to schools and the big fight, Brown v. Board and so forth, right, you get the reproduction of unprecedented opportunities on the white side of town, unbelievable social misery and mechanisms of exclusion, discrimination on the black and brown sides of town. And I would add, when it comes to women, without the federal support, if it were just up to the local and the state, and this is certainly true when it comes to gays and lesbians, you see, that we'd be in a world of trouble. The cultural conservatism and the cultural contempt of women and people of color and of gays and lesbians and so forth on the local level.
Yes.
Requires some kind of federal intervention.
Let's go back to the example you mentioned, Chris, of the war economy in the Second World War. Mm. So it was sensational in its effect. In 4 years, from 1941 to 1945, GDP in the United States doubled.
Oh.
And not only was there a massive mobilization of resources, not only did the top marginal rate of the personal income tax go above 90%, now unbelievable to Americans living today, but the whole economy was run on principles that contradicted the supposedly sacrosanct dogmas of the American free market order. So in other words, when the Americans wanted to and when they needed to,
they
discarded their dogmas as if they were a mask. And they organized things in a completely different
way. We still got a permanent war economy since 1945 at this very moment. That's true for Democrats. It's true for Republicans across the board. It's true for Elizabeth Warren with all of her magnificent critiques of Wall Street. She's still a militarist. She's still tied to military-industrial complex. That's true for almost every Democrat in that Democratic Party. Why? Because you don't get elected. You don't reproduce yourself without adjusting to that lie. And yet everybody knows there's vicious things going on. Why? Because nobody wants, out of courage and integrity, to cut radically against that grain within the narrow parochial context of American electoral politics.
You spoke of the American prophets, not just the founders, Emerson.
Yes.
Whitman.
Lincoln.
Right. Melville.
Lincoln. Later Lincoln.
What would their critique be of this global imperial system that we're now managing from Mosul to Pyongyang?
That it corrupts the republic. And one of the forms of the corruption has been the change to a so-called volunteer army, which is a mercenary army, an army of poor people paid to undertake the military expeditions of the United States. That should be unacceptable to everyone who is a defender of Republican institutions. The army must be the people in arms, the nation in arms, not part of the nation paid by the rest to defend them.
It's a 40-year habit now of the mercenary
indeed.
Army. Can it be undone?
In order to untie the hands of the people in power. That's an example of the fundamental problem, of a missing debate in American life.
Well, there's no doubt that Walt Whitman's Democratic Vistas, if read in public today, would be viewed as a revolutionary document. Mm. There's no doubt about that. In the same way, Melville's Confidence Man, or Barnaby, read that right in front of Wall Street. I prefer not. Mm. I know what's going on here. I resist the great refusal that Marcuse talked about in the essay on liberation, you see.
What's the way of doing things that minimizes disturbance to the ruling interests and to the entrenched preconceptions? But how strong are these constraints? The only way you can know is by determining what's weighing on the other side of the scales. Now, the problem now is that the other side of the scales is largely empty. The transformative will, the transformative imagination, the project that is struggling against the constraints. Until you've determined the content and nature and force of that project, you can't measure the constraints. The constraints are infinite. And that's the situation that the country is now in.
The national security state, the surveillance, the police, the FBI, the CIA, those are constraints that are very real. Anybody who's speaking fundamental truths about the depth of corruption in this society, tied to wealth inequality, tied to white supremacy and male supremacy, is subject to character or literal assassination. That is a constraint.
Mm.
Or the movement itself is subject to massive repression. That is a constraint. It doesn't mean that constraint is inevitable. It can be pushed, but you have to be mindful of it if you love your family. You got to be mindful of it if you love the people you're trying to struggle with. And you have to be, like Melville, committed to a struggle for human dignity and decency, regardless of what the constraints are, because that's the kind of choice you decide to make as a human being. He did it as an artist. You're selling 75 copies, 89 copies, 112 copies. He didn't give a goddamn. He's going to speak his truth.
Melville was out of print when he died, too.
Melville broke the Ten Commandments, but he remained a revolutionary till the end. Emerson, grand that he was, and he is a towering figure. He couldn't set foot in Harvard for 30 years after the Divinity Address. He ends up on the board. He goes establishment. Melville never.
The sum of all of these constraints fails to explain the abdication of the progressives.
That's right. I agree.
They have not abdicated because of the constraints.
I agree.
They have abdicated because they have abdicated.
No, they've abdicated because they have chosen complicity, complacency, conformity, and cowardice. That's why they abdicate. That's why people abdicate. They get scared. They get intimidated. They get weary. They don't want to fight anymore.
Speak to and speak about your students. Hundreds of black, white, brown, male, female. Every sort of student sits rapt at your conversations every week. I keep thinking, I went to college during the Kennedy administration. John F. Kennedy himself spoke to our graduating class. We thought we knew, what public life was all about and how it worked. What are those students making of the situation today, and what are they asking from you?
I just feel blessed to be in a place where, even giving its ruling class constraints, you have robust conversation about some of the most crucial issues so that the young people get a chance to have access to Brother Roberto. They never seen anybody like him before. Not at all. Roberto was about as atypical a law professor as one could imagine.
What is that thing they've come for?
And obviously, a genuine thinker. A genuine thinker, an organic intellectual, one who's not been blinded by the disciplines, one who's willing to think against the grain, to be iconoclastic, to be
in many ways idiosyncratic in the best sense of that word, you know. And he's old school. As much as he talks about the future, he actually represents the best of the past. And that's Socrates, that's Jesus, that's Amos. That is Whitman. That is the later Lincoln. That's Martin Luther King Jr. That's Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and Edward Said. That's what you get in a Roberto Unger. And thank God Harvard still is a place where this kind of thing takes place. And it's a beautiful thing.
Many of these young people are oscillating between two attitudes. So one attitude is that the only thing that it's possible to do in the world is to mitigate evil, to make things less bad, to diminish the quotient of cruelty in social life, the humanization of the inevitable as the program of the progressives. The other attitude is that there's hope. There's an alternative. Now, people used to believe in alternatives in the form of these blueprints that the classical liberals and socialists peddled. And now no one can believe in these blueprints. So the search is for some other way of imagining the alternatives. Does it exist? That's what they're asking. Mm. As all of us in the world, like Thomas, we have to touch the wound to believe. And we don't know whether we can believe or should believe.
Well, I tell you, we're going to wrestle with this issue of hope, though. I think it's something that we have to come to terms with again, because I think of Thucydides. You remember in the Melian Dialogue where he talks about hope? It provides comfort in danger, but it leads toward ruin if it's not done in the right way. And this is where hope and optimism have to be distinguished. This is where costly, mature hope has to be distinguished from cheap hope and immature hope. And it might be that the hope language itself has been colonized. I mean, Obama colonized and led us up against a wall, and now the wall's even worse. So that maybe you just have to no longer talk about hope, just be a hope without invoking hope. And that's where we are in terms of how some of our most precious virtues have been so thoroughly turned against us. You see, the marketization of hope, the commodification of hope, makes it difficult at times to talk about the kind of hope Roberto's talking about, or what Whitman was talking about, or the blues talking about.
As Cornell said, hope is not optimism. Optimism is just prediction. And prediction is the position of the fatalist and the ironist. Hope is an existential orientation.
Absolutely.
It's the shadow and the reward of transformative action.
And joy. It's not about pleasure.
And St. Paul, don't forget St. Paul. We rejoice also in tribulations, for out of tribulations comes experience. Out of experience, patience. Out of patience, hope.
But Paul had an apocalyptic imagination. You see, he's like the diggers. He thought that the world could be turned upside down very quickly. You say, Paul, that your Savior has come and gone, and the world is still a dark, cruel place.
Now, we on the other hand, believe in turning the world upside down.
We want to turn it
little
upside
by little, down. Step by step. So it's this drama of spiritual oscillation that is being played out in voice or silently in our classroom. And I would like to see it played out more generally in the country.
I'm so happy to be hearing it on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Roberto Unger. Thank you, Cornell West.
Thank you, brother.
The last time Cornell West and Roberto Unger gave their course at Harvard, 20 years ago, they made a book of it, The Future of American Progressivism. The book and the future are still out there. We're hungry for lots more alternative conversations on the suspense and anxiety around social reality, culture, climate, health, and the gap in well-being and opportunity in our country just entering the age of Trump. Help us out, please, with names of people who make sense to you. Could be all the more interesting if they're not book writers or Harvard professors. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Corton, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. Susan Coyne is our in-house artist. Look for her illustrations on our website, radioopensource.org, where there's loads more conversations, too. Don't miss George Saunders and Mohsin Hamid. And while you're there, sign up for our podcast, subscribe to our newsletter, and think about making a donation to the hardest working team in radio. No question about it. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.